Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wang. And this is the time of year in the Northwest when it's hard to be inside. In fact, being indoors in the Northwest in the summer, it almost feels like a crime. Summer is when we go to the beach, we go camping. It's when we make plans to hit the road and do fun stuff. We tagged along with Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer and his kids when they went exploring one weekend back in 2015. Except where they went, it wasn't sunny. They went on a road trip to the Hoh Rainforest.
There's so much moss, way more moss than usual. The planet made of moss. It's just too beautiful here. It's so fun. Because there's like trees that are like perfect for me climbing.
And that's our theme today, road trip. We're going to revisit some of our favorite stories that took us to some pretty interesting and unique places. Coming up, we'll meet a man who is going on an epic road trip to build friendships in the transgender community. And we'll head to the small town of Soap Lake in eastern Washington to learn about a big dream that involves an enormous lava lamp. But first, let's get back to Gabe's trip to the Hoh Rainforest on the Olympic Peninsula. Did you know that it rains something like 12 to 13 feet every year in the Hoh? While Gabe was there, he wanted to know how all of this water shapes the landscape. So he put that question to Ranger John Preston. He's the lead interpretive officer at Olympic National Park.
Well, all living things need water. It is that magical solvent that transports all the nutrients we need through our bodies. It doesn't matter whether you're a tree or a salmon or a human being. Water is essential for those life processes. And it gives everybody time to just crank out some impressive growth rates, creating an ecosystem that has the highest biomass in the world, highest mass of living and previously living matter. It is densely packed with vegetation, and the vegetation reaches proportions that are awe-inspiring and humbling, like that Sitka spruce we were just looking at. Just massive trees that grow rapidly. This forest beats all forests on the planet in terms of surface area. Every thread of moss is a surface on which some animal can live. And every layer of moss is packed with them. And they live upon the backs of their dead ancestors. It creates arboreal soil at the base of the moss layer. The trees, instead of just putting roots out into the ground, put roots out into the moss layer and derive nutrients from that, because nobody's going to let anything go to waste.
So let's talk about that moss for a second, because that's one of the most visually striking things when you just walk in here off the street. You know, you see all this moss hanging around and piled high, and I mean, it's just really amazing. How important is it in the ecosystem overall, and how does it make this place different than other kinds of forests?
Well, let's take a walk over here and see if we can just get our hands on a big, thick moss mat. So, smell that, Gabriel. It smells just like turning soil over into your garden. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at this big handful of it. It is about a 40-year accumulation of moss.
Just in your hand. I mean, it looks like a planty wig, that what you're holding in your hand.
Right, right. It looks like a toupee. And so moss acts as a big, huge filter for raindrops. Now, raindrop coalesces around a particle of dust, a microscopic particle of dust. And when it hits this moss layer, a moss layer this thick, that water percolates down, but the dust stays. The moss filters it out. And gradually, that dust works its way to the bottom, creating a layer of mineral soil. And it gets populated by all these arthropods, tiny arthropods like mites, a lot of nematodes in here, and you know, any number of creatures that live their entire lives in here, including a lot of tiny spiders in this forest. Mm. I mean, bazillions of them. They die here, and they are made up of potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, creating a layer of organic soil. And that's when the trees can really derive nutrients from it. We have this kind of song. Do you want to hear a song?
Of course I want to hear a song.
Okay. The itsy bitsy spider moved into the moss. Along came a mosquito and landed on that moss. Then the spider ran out, sunk its fangs into it, secreted digestive juices, and sucked its brains out. And so you have all this predation, and the stuff is, you know, all those nutrients are going down to the bottom. It becomes a whole layer of soil that doesn't exist in other forests.
So you've got this stuff over a huge percentage of this forest that is just a whole kind of envelope of life that doesn't exist in a lot of other places.
Right. If you think of other forests as kind of like these maybe double-level suburban places, this one is a metropolis of skyscrapers with, you know, multiple condos that go clear up, you know, 75 meters into the sky. I mean, it's an amazing place. All kinds of habitat, all kinds of surfaces on which to live.
So here we are in one of the wettest landscapes in North America, or at least in the lower 48, that's for sure. I just wonder how you feel about rain these days.
Well, I get phone calls. I answer the phone all the time. Questions from visitors coming out here. And they say they want to come out here when it's nice. And if you like it, shiny, clean, pristine, fresh. I don't know. January's pretty nice to me. I love the rain. I love the sound it makes. It means that one basic component of life is available to me. I'm not crawling across some dry desert looking for water. That it's close to me gives me comfort. Being around a multitude of different kinds of living things also brings me great joy and comfort. Yeah, this place has tremendous meaning to me that way. And I think that's why thousands and thousands of people come here. Maybe to experience that, get a piece of it, to taste it.
John Preston, who mans the wettest ranger station in the lower 48 here at the Hoh Rainforest, thank you for showing us around your very moist world.
Thank you, Gabriel. This is a lot of fun.
Hi, guys. What have you been doing?
Walking.
Getting wet?
Yeah.
Cool.
That story from Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer. One of the best things about traveling, whether it's close to home or in another country, is meeting new people. One man from Spokane decided to travel specifically to build a more tight-knit community. He's transgender, and he knows firsthand how transitioning can sometimes be scary and lonely. So he set out to connect trans men from different cities and towns with each other. And he did this by going on an epic road trip. 88.5's Kyle Norris has the story.
Malcolm René Ribot cracks open a road atlas, and he points to a map of the United States.
This marks my route of the states that I've been to so far.
This whole thing is highlighted with red magic marker to show where he's been. He's been on the road for a year and a half with his pup named Grayson.
I don't even know where to start. Okay. Chicago, South Bend, Cleveland, Pittsburgh.
And he's still going strong. Philadelphia, the only states he hasn't hit yet are Alaska, Albany, and Hawaii.
Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland.
Malcolm is 28, and he lives in Spokane for now. He's a transgender man. That means he was born female and has transitioned to male. And in every town he visits, he puts out a call to other transgender men to meet up for drinks or dinner, or just to do something fun like go hiking or go rock climbing. Malcolm has met more than 1,000 transgender men so far. Now, we're going to come back to this whole road trip thing, but first you've got to understand Malcolm's story. His parents were in the Army, and Malcolm moved around a lot as a kid. During that time, he'd never heard of LGBTQ or even gender identity. Till about 10 years ago, when he was a student at the Illinois Institute of Art for College outside of Chicago. It's about the time he realized he was not happy. He was presenting as female at the time. He was dating a man, and they were on the road to marriage.
But I had all these thoughts, and I didn't understand them, and then finally, once I met somebody who was also trans, they gave me the language to understand what my thoughts meant and how I feel, and then finally, I was like, it just clicked.
Malcolm started going to support groups for transgender people to meet other folks. He met M to F, male to female people, and F to M, female to male. But the people he really connected with were those transmasculine guys.
I just remember how important it was for me in the beginning of my transition, having others around that I could talk to about everything and like express my concerns, to celebrate with, you know, all of it.
And the trans men in his life helped guide him as he transitioned socially and physically. They supported him in a way others just couldn't, including transgender women and cisgender men. That means men who are born male and identify as male. Because trans men go through some really specific things that others just don't.
Just getting the okay to be able to go on testosterone. And then having our first shot. We tend to have parties. Some of my cis friends would come too, but you could just see like how excited the other trans men were for you, as opposed to like people who may be cisgender don't understand how exciting it really is for you. To be able to just like jump around with your other trans male friends over starting testosterone, having name change, gender marker change, new ID.
As he transitioned, he would post about it online. He got kind of famous. 43,000 people follow him on Instagram, where he is known as Gorilla Shrimp. Now, that's a nickname based off of some doodles he used to make of hybrid animals. It's also a hat tip to his small size. Malcolm is 5'1". He says the name means small and mighty. Malcolm didn't set out to do a road trip across the country. It just happened. People had started to reach out to him online and share their stories, and they would ask him questions. And so he developed friendships with some of these folks. He went to Massachusetts to visit a trans guy who said he didn't know any other transgender people. But Malcolm knew for a fact that another trans guy lived about half an hour away, and that guy said he didn't know any transgender people. So Malcolm put the two in touch.
I just thought it was crazy because my reality was that I knew guys and I hung out with them all the time. So learning that others didn't have that, it just clicked. Like, I need to help these guys connect with one another. So it started as one-on-ones at first. And I was just helping them get each other's contact information. And with their permission, I was posting pictures with them. And I saw that that was starting to spread visibility in the community and out of the community, actually. So people in the community were seeing it and they were commenting and saying, hey, with each new picture you post, I'm seeing how much less and less alone I am.
More and more people were reaching out, so Malcolm decided, why not keep traveling? He has done this whole thing on a shoestring budget. He'll stay with the people he meets, and they'll feed him and let him crash on the couch. He's taken a few months off here and there to save some money and stay in one place. He works as a freelance graphic designer or as a driver for Lyft and Uber. But the whole idea is to save money to go back out on the road. Transgender people face misunderstanding and judgment and fear and hate. And sometimes that comes from their own families. Malcolm's got a story about that. He had just met a trans man and his wife and says they were super nice. And then the next day, he met a young trans man who was homeless. His family had kicked him out of the house for being transgender.
He was the one living out of his truck with his dog. And I didn't have much time to meet up with him, but I told him that I had just met someone really nice the day before, and I was like, you guys should definitely link up. And I gave them their personal information and then went on my way. And then I found out that they contacted each other, and yeah, he gave him a place to live. Like, they became family, essentially, and they call each other brothers.
The formerly homeless guy even hangs out with the couple's extended family and watches football games with them.
That's my favorite story, because when he messaged me like a couple months later, he was like, hey man, because of you, I now have new friends, a family, and a place to live.
Malcolm is always thinking about safety. That's why he doesn't publicly post the meetup locations. He's afraid someone could do something violent if they knew a bunch of transgender people were meeting in a public place. These meetups are a chance for trans men to be respected for who they are. And for some, that might be the only time that happens in their month or in their year.
Knowing that the people around us are going to use the right pronouns. They're not going to ask us invasive questions about our genitalia. They're just not. You know, it's a safe space where we can talk about those things if we want to, you know, if we feel comfortable.
Malcolm has met trans men all over the country, on their turf, in tiny towns and in big cities. And he's realized there's a lot of variety when it comes to transitioning and gender identity. Some people go on hormones and some don't. Some have surgeries, some don't. And some change their names. Some don't.
And there's no right or wrong way, which is the beauty of it, really. It's all what we personally need for ourselves to feel whole and comfortable in our skin.
Malcolm's dream is to hit all 50 states. And once he does that, he might head to Canada or even overseas to connect trans men all over the world. And on a personal note, Malcolm has been a big inspiration for me. I'm also transitioning. I was raised female, but I've always felt masculine. And I've learned that transitioning is this big jumping into the unknown, meaning you're going to make a change to be more yourself, but you don't know what you will feel like or look like or sound like. It's terrifying. It's also thrilling and incredibly vulnerable. And seeing someone like Malcolm so far down the road is a big relief because he seems happy. He seems normal. He seems engaged with the world. And it's big inspiration and evidence it'll be okay.
That story was from 88.5's Kyle Norris. Welcome back. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing. And our theme today is road trip. For our next story, 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe headed to Vancouver, Washington. This is home to the United States Geological Survey Cascades Volcano Observatory, where 82 scientists track the volcanoes and the Cascades like they're their patients. They keep stats on them that are like mood diaries as they try to personality type them and predict how they'll behave in the future based on the past.
You know, lava is really primordial. It's kind of where rock is created. It's a window into the Earth, the really deep part of the Earth.
The Mount St. Helens sector collapse, it was the biggest landslide in recorded history in the world.
When Lewis and Clark came through downriver, down the Columbia River, there was a large quicksand bar that extended most of the way across the Columbia River. But they never made the connection that this was a lahar that had come off of Mount Hood.
The eruption we had at St. Helens in 2004, there were some periods of time where the earthquakes were remarkably regularly spaced, just like heartbeats.
With every eruption that happens at Mount Hood, which sends sediment down in a lahar, Oregon gains a few acres and Washington loses them.
I've got another 10, 15 years to go, and it would not surprise me to have St. Helens erupt again in that time.
It's like thousands of years of boredom interspersed with moments of terror.
That was seismologist Seth Moran, volcanologist Larry Mastin, and hydrologist Carolyn Dreger. In one corner of the observatory, Bellamy found John Pallister. He is the chief of the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which has partnerships around the world to respond to volcano crises and help save lives before an eruption happens. He tells Bellamy that this program began 30 years ago.
It started after a real tragedy in Colombia where 23,000 people died when a lahar, that's a volcanic mud flow of the type that might come off right Mount Rainier, for example, came down and basically wiped out a city. It was a real tragic event, and it inspired people in USAID, off the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and USGS to get together with the commitment that we'd try to make sure that this never happens again. And so that's the underlying premise of our work. We try to get to a volcano when it's acting up, but before it erupts, to notify people. We provide the monitoring equipment. We provide training and expertise, having done this in a lot of different countries around the world. And then our partners are the ones who effect an evacuation to save lives and property. So over the years, I guess we estimate we've helped our partners save tens of thousands of lives.
Merapi. Tell me what the story of Merapi.
Merapi is one of the world's most hazardous volcanoes, not particularly because it has very large eruptions, but because it has a huge population living on its flanks. It's in central Java. Yogyakarta is the cultural capital of Indonesia, and more than a million people living right downslope on the south side of that volcano. It erupts on average every 4 years. In 2010, though, it had what we call a 100-year eruption, much, much larger than its normal eruptions, and the onset and the precursors were very short-lived. And so within about a week, it went from looking like a normal small eruption to a much, much larger eruption. Fortunately, our partners had really worked closely with the communities, much like we do here with the communities around Tacoma and up around Mount Rainier or here in Mount Hood for Portland. They had worked very closely with those communities, so they had evacuation plans, they had the whole system set up. And again, the night of the eruption, they went from 15 to 20 kilometers for the evacuation radius from the volcano, and in that 15 to 20 kilometers, that meant effectively about 80,000 people had to run for their lives down the hill. They succeeded, and they saved about 20,000 lives, I calculate.
Wow. So we were talking earlier about how this is not just about saving lives, though. In some cases, it's helping with international relations, and it's also helping your team stay in shape as they work internationally. They stay in practice, right?
And this is an important point. You might ask, why does the USGS have an international program? Well, partly it's international diplomacy, and it's helping the State Department. But the other part of it is we get experience that we use domestically by doing these responses and by assisting our partners and by having workshops to develop best practices. That those people who responded to Pinatubo in 1991 are the same people that responded to Mount St. Helens when it woke up in 2004.
Pinatubo, that was the big one in 1991 in the Philippines, the largest eruption on Earth in the last 100 years, I read.
Yeah.
It was in a densely populated area and many people were killed, but also tens of thousands of lives saved.
That international experience pays off big time when you get back to this country and we deal with Alaskan eruptions, Hawaiian eruptions, and eruptions here in the Cascades. In fact, one of our biggest challenges here in the Cascades is because the eruptions are infrequent, they're about 10 times more active internationally than they are in the U.S. And so by this international experience, we get people, get them experience. We test equipment. The Lahar system at Mount Rainier that we use for monitoring the potential future Lahars has been tested internationally at other volcanoes that are actively having Lahars. So it's a proving ground for our instrumentation. It's a proving ground for our people. I like to say that you wouldn't want a medical student to perform open heart surgery on you. You'd want that student to have some experience first. By doing this international work, our people, our scientists, our technicians, our engineers get the international experience that we bring home.
How does the communication work?
Well, the volcanology and volcano hazards community in the world is small. Most of us know each other. And in going through crises, you become fast friends. So, you know, when a friend asks for help, you help, and as best you can. So that's really how it works. It's based on friendships.
Yeah, it's a form of diplomacy. Through your work together, you learn other things about each other. And with the goal of saving lives, you're really rising above day-to-day politics.
We do something we call science diplomacy because, you know, when you have friends in different countries that begin to understand their cultures, their differences, their political differences, the science diplomacy, the humanitarian response cuts through all of that. And so we've been called on in the past to come in to assist partners that also help our embassies and help our Foreign Service staff to build relationships that are non-confrontational and that begin to, in some cases, reestablish relationships between our country and other countries that have been strained.
What would be examples of that?
We were asked to respond to Ecuador, to the crisis at Cotopaxi. That's a volcano much like Mount Rainier, an ice-clad volcano that's subject to producing very, very large lahars, mud flows. And we were asked to come in at a time where the relations were not that great between our two countries, and yet we were welcome because of the humanitarian aspects of our work. Same thing in Nicaragua. We've responded in the last 2 years to a crisis at Momotombo volcano in Nicaragua, and that was a case where, again, somewhat strained relationships between our countries, but the humanitarian effort cuts through.
How often do you get the email asking for help?
We get requests for crisis assistance, for sending, deploying a team of specialists. I'd say on average, recently it's been 3 or 4 times a year.
Is there a moment over the course of your career, particularly in your years with this international program, VDAP, that you are most proud of?
Probably the science response to Pinatubo, where I discovered with partners the trigger for the eruption, what caused that eruption. and was mixing of two very different magmas. That mixing is what allowed the gas to exsolve to drive the powerful explosion. That was kind of a breakthrough in our understanding of what triggers big explosive eruptions. So it is a dichotomy. It's a dichotomy of, on one side, the scientific, the understanding, the process, the hard science, if you will, the physics, the math, the chemistry, that all goes into that. And then on the other side, it's using that science to then, you know, for this humanitarian effort. It's one of the fields where the rewards from that long-term scientific investment come very fast, and you can actually see them being applied to save lives. That's not that common. We see it in medicine, of course, when, you know, a new drug is developed, a new technique is developed. I think this is unusual in geology to be able to see the results of your investigations and your science be applied in real time.
That was John Pallister, chief of the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, talking to 88.5's environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX, and our theme today is Road Trip. Next, we head to Yakima. And this is a story about theft. For decades, entire generations of Native Americans were robbed of their language and their culture and their history. It happened at boarding schools. Native American students were forbidden from expressing their Indian identities. The founder of some of the most infamous boarding schools coined this phrase for what he was trying to do. Kill the Indian in him to save the man. Russell Jim is a member of the Yakima tribe, and as a child, his father was taken to one of these boarding schools in Pennsylvania. Then in the 1940s, Jim himself was taken to a boarding school in Oregon. Here is his story.
My name is Russell Jim. I'm the project director of the Environmental Restoration Waste Management Program for the Yakima Nation. My father, because of many things, World War I included, he got sick easy. He blames it on gas over there for his hair turning prematurely white. When I was 3 months old, my dad took me to his sister and said, I can't raise him, I can't feed him. She raised me. One day, I saw a little suitcase. I saw some great-looking pants in there, some great-looking homemade shirts. I said, what's the occasion? And that was when they came and said, it's your turn to go. And I didn't really know what they meant. I was only 5 years old at the time. Down here in Toppenish, Washington, they had a Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's where they took me and loaded me on the bus. And my aunt was standing right outside there looking at me. Whenever I wanted anything at all, all I had to do was let big tears run down and she'd go get it for me. And I realized that I was leaving for some reason or other, and I started to cry. She looked at me for a bit and turned and walked away. My first witness at the power of the white man. They took me to Chemawa, that place in Oregon. Eventually, you know, a Sunday came around, the first Sunday I was there, and they took me to a room with rows and rows and rows of white shirts. They found two white shirts that fit me, wrote my name inside the collar. They said, each Sunday you come here and you get this white shirt, put it on, go to their Lutheran church, listen to the angels coming in every morning singing the song, you know. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. And as I found out later on, it was not an education institute, it was an assimilation institute. They tried to discipline everybody whenever they'd find us speaking our language. They'd beat us, they'd spank us, spank our hands, tell us, no, 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 bad, bad. They did that to my sister so bad that eventually throughout the rest of her life, she could understand every word of Indian I spoke. We spoke to her, but she couldn't repeat one sentence without going into a trauma. That's how bad they beat her. There was two other guys, two little guys my age. We found out we could understand Yakima. So we'd sneak around, speak to each other in whispers. We found a loose board one time, and three of us would periodically go sneak under there among all the dust and all that, sit there and speak our language to each other. We'd giggle knowing it was illegal according to the non-Indians, but then we'd also cry because we'd get lonesome. And the punishments were morally made to shame us, belittle you. You wet the bed and they'd wash your face in front of everybody with that damp sheet. Then Saturday morning, we had to run the gauntlet, which means everybody got to line the hallway. The guy with the most demerits had to run down that hallway and everybody gets to have their belt take a swipe at him. And even at 5 years old, I used to realize, you know, why am I doing this? And it's a way to teach you how to punish your own. There are so many things that went on there that when I finally came home and I relayed this to my aunt that raised me, she went to my father and said, you can send the rest of your children to that school if you want to. This one's not going. If you don't want to do that, take him to the hills and you'll never find us. She could have did it too. So he took me down to the nearest school within a mile of where we lived. The public school, Garfield School here in Toppenish. And he was told, oh, we don't allow Indians in this school. So he went to the Veterans of Foreign Wars and American Legion, and the next day they all marched down there and said, you don't allow this boy in the school, we're gonna sue you and shut you down. So they let me in. Then I had to whip every boy in that class. They didn't like Indians. Today, the younger generation is not speaking the language like they should be. I think part of it is because in places like Chamawa, psychologically that was put in the minds of your grandparents. That mindset is passed down through the generations. Many who didn't want to be embarrassed by being Indian assimilated. Many of the half-breeds who look like you, they wouldn't admit there were any Indian. Most of them today don't understand the language, and especially when they lose a loved one, an elder. That elder says, I want to go through the ceremonies when I die. I want to go the old way, So we take care of them in the old way, and then the younger generation gets up and says, why can't I do this? Why can't I speak my language? Why can't I sing these songs? They're lost.
The story was produced by Matthew Stribe. Russell Jim says the Yakima parents still send their kids to boarding schools. Jim, however, is raising two of his grandchildren at home. Today, these boarding schools are still controversial. They're considered to be an escape from the poverty that exists on many of the reservations. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. And for this last story, we are going to stick around in eastern Washington, specifically Soap Lake. It's a small town in the middle of the state, and it's home to about 1,600 people. And its economy has seen better days. Now, a lot of small towns in that situation might respond by trying to lure a big box store or coming up with a snappy tourist slogan. Those ambitions, they are too puny for Soap Lake. Instead, since the early 2000s, the town has been working toward creating something big and weird and really kind of beautiful. They want to build the world's largest lava lamp. So Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer got curious about this and met up with five enthusiastic city elders: Mayor Raymond Gravel, Don Long, Burr Beckwith, Andy Kovac, and his wife, Nell Kovac, on a scraggly bluff up above Soap Lake.
So they kind of gestured toward this empty space there amongst the brush and invited me to picture this 65-foot-high lava lamp that would kind of tower up above the lake and would be the highest structure in the town for miles, except for the water towers. And this is an idea that they have been working on for a really long time.
Basically, it's an idea that won't die. There's a certain magic about this lamp. And so the lamp could be like the Space Needle is for Seattle.
They really do kind of see this as their meal ticket. You know, things have not been great in places like Soap Lake. So Andy Kovac, the architect, imagines this as like plunking down a little Eiffel Tower or a little Statue of Liberty right there in the middle of central Washington.
You know, these small towns are having a tough time everywhere. I've seen so many businesses come and go. People struggle. It's sad. If this happens, then we have a chance, a big chance.
When it happens.
Yeah. So as you can hear, these guys are thinking big. And you can really get the sense of that when you talk to Raymond Gravel. He's the mayor of Soap Lake. He's lived there for 10 years. And he actually moved to Soap Lake because of the lava lamp. Like, he and his wife were living in North Bend, and they were kind of looking to make a change, and then they sort of heard about this place, Soap Lake.
There was a motorcycle rally in Soap Lake. Oh, that's kind of interesting. What's Soap Lake? And then, of course, as soon as you Google that, you see the giant lava lamp. Oh, that's intriguing. And then the next thing you see is this mineral water. We just had to come over and say, hey, let's find out. And then we kept coming, and that's when we decided we were just going to sell everything, quit our corporate jobs, and start over in Soap Lake.
So the Gravels arrived, and then they met a guy named Brent Blake. And he is an important character in this story. He is the guy who came up with the whole idea for the lava lamp. He cooked this thing up. And Blake was an artsy type. He was a visionary. He was kind of a larger-than-life character, which raises the question, you know, was this whole idea cooked up in some kind of a drug haze? Well, they assure me that the answer is no, although the Drug Association has definitely kept a few scattered people in town from fully embracing the lava lamp idea. But no, they say this was all about art and creativity and really Brent Blake's free spirit, which Mayor Gravel says was very infectious.
Pretend I have a ponytail. It just went off a couple of months ago.
Oh, wait, you had a ponytail?
I had a ponytail, and I'd always had a clean corporate haircut until I moved to Soap Lake. I met Brent, was fascinated, recognized why he was called the Renaissance man, the visionary, and he had a ponytail. And I thought, well, if he can have a ponytail, I'm going to try one.
So Soap Lake is the place to go to get loose, it turns out. And a lot of it was because of this guy, Brent Blake, this charismatic, visionary person. So Blake unfortunately got leukemia and he died in 2013. But his dream definitely did not die with him.
One of the things that I promised was to do my very best with whatever abilities and powers as mayor that I had to get the lava lamp built.
Did you really make him a promise when toward the end of his life?
Yes. Yes.
That's some serious stuff.
It is. And I'm the kind of person that keeps my promises, and this group knows that. We all have the same promise.
The thing is, the original plan for the lava lamp was to make an actual 65-foot lava lamp. And if you've ever seen those things, you know they're full of water, and they have a heating element in the bottom, and it heats up wax, and the wax goes bloop, 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 and it kind of globbles up and down and makes this mesmerizing thing. But imagine a 65-foot-high version of that. Think about how much water you would need. Think about how much wax you would need, like tons and tons of it, and how much energy you would need to heat it up. And so they started to kind of figure out what it would take to actually build one of these things. And here's Andy Kovac describing how Brent Blake sort of wrestled with that.
In the end, it simply wasn't, from a physics standpoint, it couldn't happen.
But why let a little thing like laws of physics stop you?
Not Brent.
So onward they went, and instead of abandoning this idea, they just dug in their heels, you know? They did not give up. And then some help arrived from an unlikely place. Basically, they got an offer for a free, pre-made, 32-ton, 50-foot-high lava lamp from Target, like the store Target. And what happened was that Target actually had one of these things that they had built in order to hang on a building in Times Square in New York as like a big advertising stunt thing. And they heard about Soap Lake's oddball dreams, and they decided to donate this 50-foot-high mechanical lava lamp.
They took it down, they disassembled it, they trucked it all the way at no cost, and it landed here. And it was a roadside attraction. I mean, it was pretty gaudy.
Pretty gaudy. In fact, the people discovered once it got there after they'd trucked it all the way across the country in pieces that they kind of didn't like it very much. It was not a real lava lamp, as we discussed. It was a mechanical thing that had these fiberglass globule thingies that sort of gave the vague impression of looking like the lava lamp. And then on top of that, it turned out it had to actually be mounted on the side of a building. It was built that way, and they didn't have a big building to stick it on. So they kind of scrapped the Target lava lamp idea. In fact, it's still sitting in some kind of sad warehouse in Soap Lake as we speak, gathering dust. But they came up with a new idea. And this came from the brain of Andy Kovac, this architect. And I'm going to try to describe it so you can imagine what it looks like. Imagine a big steel pole, 60 feet high or whatever, that has these cables, these guy wires coming off of it, kind of maypole style. And then you wrap that cone in a special metallic fabric.
Kind of like a teepee. And then we had two laser light projectors on the inside located up above that would project in the round 360 degrees anything we wanted to project on a computer. You know, the technology really is there. It's starting to catch up to the point that I'm afraid somebody else is going to do it before us.
The idea was that these projectors would project the gloopy globules of the lava lamp thing onto the sides and give the illusion of the lava lamp motion. And I've seen the renderings, the artist's renderings, and it does look really pretty cool. And Mayor Gravel assured me that even though it's a lava lamp, it's going to be classy.
The thing about this is it will be a piece of art. It won't be this big, clunky, garish metal thing out there. It'll be beautiful.
Yeah. How do you see it as being different from a novelty or a roadside attraction kind of thing?
Well, I mean, there's that element. You can't deny that. But like a pit full of rattlesnakes and stuff like is one thing. But if you have something like that, it is a work of art. It's a plus.
You could have a ready-made laser light show on this lava lamp thing. And in fact, there's a pretty famous laser light show that happens just up the river at Grand Coulee Dam, and they sort of thought that this could complement it. And then there were other things you could do, too. You could put ads on it, potentially. You could invite people to have their company picnic out there and put the corporate logo on the lava lamp. I mean, they are actually thinking practically about it in a way that makes you think maybe this is an actual doable civic project. So talking that way, it's hard not to get carried away by this whole sense of enthusiasm and this can-do spirit of this small town. But I learned as things went on that there is one small hitch, and here's how Andy Kovac explained it.
The company that owns the rights, we were working with their CEO, and he was all over this project. He was going to be here at the opening. he left. The new guy came in and said, I want nothing to do with this. And this is after we put so much effort into this project. It was pretty incredible. We really want them to work with us, and we're going to continue to pursue that. And so we're taking our time and trying to do that as positively and correctly as possible.
So, yeah, they don't really have the buy-in anymore from the company that makes lava lamps. And because of that, they haven't actually been able to raise money to do it. And so it's kind of stalled the whole thing out. And I did call the company Lifespan Products, which now holds the trademarks to lava lamps. And they promised to call me back with a statement and did not. There is a page on their website that talks all about their trademarks, because this has come up over and over again online, because people Photoshop lava lamps into stuff and all kinds of stuff. And so they have this whole thing that says, hey, we're free spirits too, but trademarks are serious business. And if you don't safeguard your trademark, you can lose it. So hard to see where that's going to go. But, you know, I got to say, if the laws of physics can't stop this project, then maybe a little legal hang up won't be such a big deal either. Here's Mayor Gravel again.
When the lava lamp's built, it'll be the beginning of a new renaissance for Soap Lake. I've told people all along, we'll have to have special traffic control. There will be traffic jams all the way down to the highway. People are going to be as mesmerized by the giant lava lamp as they are by the one sitting in their living room.
That story from Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer. That's going to do it for this week's show. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson, with help this week from Gabriel Spitzer, Bellamy Palethorpe, Matthew Stribe, Kyle Norris, and Arwen Nix. We get web help from Simone Alisea, and Parker Miles Blom helps with photos and videos. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. If you missed part of the show or any other episode of Sound Effect, you can catch up by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, where you can get all 107 episodes that we've aired so far. And you can also rate and review the show there, which is a really big help to us. You can also hear our stories on the NPR One app and see photos, videos, and other extras on our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. And we would love to hear from you, whether it's a story idea or some feedback on the show. Email us at soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, when our theme is What a Mess.
You see the people coming towards you with buckets, and then you feel it just like on your hair and your shoulders. It literally felt like goo dropped on you. I definitely remember thinking, I cannot wait to tell my two best friends that this happened. And will anyone actually believe me?
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.